It's time for David Taraschuk with the Media Beat. David does join us on a Friday morning. We talk about media coverage, about what's going on in and around the world. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And there's a lot going on, especially, we've got Ukraine, but a pretty big election, which could bring a very, very, very big change in the United Kingdom. Good morning, David.
Hello there. It's good to be joining you. Joining the ever thoughtful Marshall Miles as I report in again, as I'm doing now, not from the media capital of the world, New York City, but from those two little islands off the western fringe of Europe, Britain and Ireland. Until last night, I was in Britain, and today I'm back in Ireland. The British media have, you're right, been pulled away somewhat from their understandable devotion to the Ukraine war. They're doing a fine job reporting on that, but now they've been focused on this major domestic political battle. Yesterday was voting day in Britain's sort of equivalent, we can say that, I think, sort of equivalent of America's midterm elections. People were voting in local municipalities throughout the country, and here in the part of Ireland still ruled by Britain, that's Northern Ireland, people were electing members of its provincial assembly, and with that, a new leadership for the provincial government as a whole, created by the peace agreement for Northern Ireland that ended the Northern Irish War. You and I were talking about that last week, Marshall, about what was at stake up there in the north. But let's talk about Britain and where I've just been. Well, the results are in. Well, some results are in. Far from all of them. Counting has really only started in Scotland and indeed in Northern Ireland. But the media are already abuzz with early breaking news, especially from London, the capital. We have to stress, of course, that these elections, this is why you were probably asking about them in the first place, Marshall, they're all happening against the background of Prime Minister Boris Johnson having gotten himself thoroughly beleaguered. We'll all have seen the raucous coverage of his being fined for breaking his own COVID rules, partying during the lockdown. In other words, the top lawmaker becoming a lawbreaker, so to speak, and that phrase is being used all the time in the British media. Oh, and of course, he's been accused of lying about it all, of course, from the beginning. Plus, there is also the distinctly unedifying spectacle of his loyal or otherwise troops in Parliament. Outraging public decency in other ways, too. Sexual misconduct seems to be rife, misogyny in various nasty forms, and even, you will have heard of this on your side of the water, I'm sure, desecrating the hallowed halls of Parliament by watching porn there, thanks to the modern miracle of the smartphone. So British journalists and opinionators, are taking these off-year elections as a barometer or bellwether for the health of Johnson's government as a whole, even while stressing all the time, of course, that these are local elections with purely local issues at stake. But sure enough, the early London results have indeed been striking in the national context, the context of Bojo's troubles. I'm sorry, I can't help reverting to that irresistible tabloid nickname for Boris Johnson, Bojo. But let's look at what's happening right in the center, Westminster, that part of London that's home to the UK Parliament. Indeed, another name for the Houses of Parliament is the Palace of Westminster. It's home to the government, that well-known Broad Street Whitehall in Westminster is a byword for government bureaucracy. And of course, 10 Downing Street, Westminster's probably its most famous residential address, the Prime Minister's home, of course. Well, Westminster has fallen to the opposition. The Labour Party won Westminster for the first time ever since its creation as a local government unit back in 1964.
That's stunning. I said that's stunning.
It's remarkable. I mean, it means that Labour will control only local matters there. I mean, fixing the potholes and so on, you know, to use the usual common commentator parlance. But you can see the huge symbolic importance of Labour taking Westminster from Johnson's Conservatives. And other London boroughs, too, are suddenly won by Labour. They carry symbolic importance as well. Wandsworth in southwest London is home to the city's charismatic mayor, Saeed Khan, incidentally its first Muslim mayor and a Labour Party man through and through, has also been lost by the Conservatives today. Wandsworth has been a bedrock for Conservatives ever since they won it in the days of Margaret Thatcher. And also up in North London, the borough of Barnet, famously another bastion of Thatcherism, a suburban bastion of that kind of political outlook, has also fallen to Labour rather amazingly. Johnson's opposite number, Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader currently, went to Barnet this morning congratulating an almost delirious welcoming crowd of supporters. But, I mean, what's really the important question here is, does it mean that Bojo might be losing his hold on power? Well, that's the question hurtling around British Airways right now and filling the news and commentary pages. The first thing we should say is that it's still early yet. So much counting still to be done. But one thing does seem clear. Labour's progress has not been so great in the rest of the country, outside London. They haven't won back, for instance, in local terms, those areas where Bojo did so well winning them from Labour in that last general election that they held nearly 3 years ago, 2019. I'd hazard a guess and say that internally, within the Conservatives, those members of Parliament who have formed so far just a trickle of protest at his leadership, registering their demand for a no-confidence vote against Johnson, they're not likely to increase in great numbers as a result of these election results, I don't think. A total of 54 such disaffected members is needed to force such a vote. Many others, especially senior Conservatives, as the election results flow in now, are actually rallying around the Prime Minister. I think I couldn't put it better than a BBC commentator this morning summing it up. It's all been pretty bad for the Conservatives, but for Labour, it has just not been good enough. So time will tell, of course, but as you know, I'm very reluctant to make predictions, but I suspect Boris Johnson is going to survive this.
But will the vote in Northern Ireland have any effect on his survivability?
Well, it won't be good for him if it goes the way that all opinion polls have been suggesting. The biggest party in Northern Ireland is likely to be, and we'll know this for sure when the results are finally tabulated much later on today. It's a fairly slow and complicated process. They have proportional representation in Northern Ireland now, a form of transferable vote that's familiar to New Yorkers, at least now. We had it in our last municipal elections in New York City. The result looks like being a victory, no other word for it really, a victory for Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA, the often called terrorist organization that held the British Army pinned down for 30 years or so in Northern Ireland until that peace agreement that established this new form of government, power-sharing government. So, in theory, at least, the new government of the province of Northern Ireland could end up being run by people associated with the IRA, the political wing of the IRA, no less. That's remarkable. And for a Conservative government in London, that's obviously not a good thing. It's not something they would ever have wanted to see happen. But the population of Northern Ireland is changing. Other issues besides the traditional ones have come to the fore. It's almost as if ordinary politics is coming back to Northern Ireland. That was something we were talking about last week. Regular matters of the cost of living, the economic issues, the pocketbook issues that are most important to most people in most countries. It's just regaining their central place, even in Northern Irish politics, which has always been dominated by that sectarian division between the nationalist population and the loyalist population. On the one hand, those who want a united Ireland, and they tend to be Catholics, and those who want to maintain the connection with Britain, and they tend to be Protestants. That simple division is no longer the predominant one in Northern Irish politics. So it will be very interesting to see what happens when they finally declare the results in Northern Ireland.
You know, you frequently, we talk about the New York Times. I think the New York Times, I'm not sure if it was the Times or not, but the two big stories have been, and I love this because this is what makes newspapers and reporters. Two big stories have been broken in the past week. One with the amazing story about a brief being released and obtained by the press and, on the Roe versus Wade decision. And then another one, which I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, but, you know, when the Russian ship was sunk by the Ukrainians, I figured, you know, they didn't do it by themselves. They, you know, you've got help from all these European nations and the United States, and you knew that tactical help was on the way, and really was helping the Ukrainians. But these were two very big stories that were broken by newspapers, and you know what? I just love to see newspapers getting back to their roots.
Well, basic journalism, yes, revealing things that institutional organizations, governments in particular, aren't especially eager to make public. That's the fundamental role of journalists, of course. And the New York Times certainly deserves credit for what they have been able to establish about the Ukrainians' attack on the iconic Russian warship. They don't deserve that much credit for the leak of the Justice Samuel Alito's draft of a judgment on the Roe versus Wade abortion issue. More credit goes to all credit really goes to Politico, which you know began as an online only. Dedicated political wonky sort of site and is now something of a journalistic empire. I've been singing the praises of Politico's British operation for some time now, but in this case, it's the home Politico based in D.C., just essentially woven into the political fabric of D.C. They got the paper, 98 pages of it, Alito's draft brief and or draft judgment, in a sense, and clearly his kind of arguing, highly contentious, and of course it sparked a lot of discussion about who would have leaked it and why, but certainly it's brought the issue back to the fore in time, significantly enough, for the midterm elections this year. But it'll be very interesting to see what, if any, changes in that draft happen before the justices as a whole, all nine of them, with one way or another, and varying degrees of agreement and dissent, publish the final judgment sometime in June, only a month away from now. But it's bread and butter journalism, and it's good to see it being done. And whoever's doing it.
Yeah, but it's still sad to see the Supreme Court. You know, like I've been saying all along, the appointees have always been political, but the Supreme Court has always tried to maintain a non-political position, and now. With this release, our Chief Justice is really in a tough place, trying to rein in the political influences that appear to be infiltrating the court.
Sure, he's clearly very concerned about the reputation of the court as a non-partisan element of our constitutional makeup. And of course, you know, when things like this happen, the truth is made very clear. You know, there's a very distinct and clear partisan split in the nine justices, and it's a supermajority for the right, and there's just no getting away from that. And quite who, you know, the old Roman motto, cui bono, who benefits, is the question at the back of all the speculation about how this leak came about and to what purpose. Who would have done it? But much more importantly, I think, is the fact that it has surfaced as an argument in the public forum again, and in the sharp terms, I guess we ought to be grateful for that, presented by San Alito. Its effect abroad is worth commenting on, too. I should report that Europe, here on this side of the Atlantic, has once again been totally agog about America, as it often is over U.S. political events. The draft opinion written by Alito, being leaked last week, astounds many Europeans. The issue at its heart, that is. If Roe v. Wade is in the post-Trump America evidently no longer settled law, as everyone, or most people were saying whenever asked about it, were saying, especially people who are nominated to that bench, and while they're being in the process of being confirmed, they would say, yes, Roe v. Wade is settled law. But here, it quite evidently is in the process of being overturned. If that's the case, then undoubtedly the contrast couldn't be stronger with Europe, where, you know, for Europeans, a woman's right to choose abortion is definitely settled. It's been settled for decades. The whole development of European policymaking on this matter, starting, of course, as it often is in social issues, with the Scandinavians to the north of Europe, but I have to say also including Britain's abortion law reform back in 1968, and then since then even including southern European countries that have their strong Catholic climates, it has meant it's simply a given part of the social landscape now. And even here in Ireland, where the church had enormous influence for decades, keeping abortion illegal seemingly forever, there was, in the end, inevitably, I think because of the social advancement that was taking place across the entire continent, there was a universal public referendum in 2018, and a landslide, two-thirds of the population said yes to abortion, and even Irish law was liberalized on the issue. So, you know, you couldn't have a bigger contrast, established the two sides of the Atlantic. And it's worth saying that another publication we're quite fond of in this spot, aren't we, Axios, has published a very good international comparison this week of other countries compared with the United States in their abortion laws. It certainly, America does seem to be the one, one of several countries, but the preeminent one that is out of step with the majority of developed countries' legal systems now that recognize the right to abortion.
And one other story I want to talk with you in, and that is the vaccines for COVID-19. There's a reason why most vaccines, when they're called upon to be developed, take years and years to develop. My brother was a vice president in a pharmaceutical company. That was his Darth Vader role, by the way, because he's a decent human. He's a decent human being now that he's retired from that position.
The dark arts of pharmaceutical business are something most families would not want to talk about. I can understand you.
But what has happened with the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine now is an eye-opener. And the FDA has put strict limits on it because this vaccine has caused some very, very serious problems that really people have to be very... People that took it and people that want to take it have to be very, very aware of because they're monitoring the vaccine and the occurrence of blood problems. This is a big story.
Sure, it's miracle drugs are something of a misnomer. We know it's a very complicated field, and. Although, you know, FDA approval might be one, especially in an emergency, and that's often what it's exactly what it is, and that's certainly what it has been during the COVID pandemic. The FDA approval and its adoption by the CDC comes as a result of very fast work, and on the basis of the examination, the external examination, independent examination of the evidence about the vaccine's effectiveness on the one hand and its potential for any side effects on the other, is a question that's often set, and certainly in this case definitely was, decided on the basis of an emergency clearance, an emergency okay, because the situation required emergency response. And of course, you know, inevitably, I think there, simple human logic would make it clear that an emergency approval or something that suits our emergency needs isn't necessarily going to be universally okay for everyone. And unfortunately, it is unfortunate for the individuals themselves who prove that, the safety of this particular vaccine, this compound is not universal. It's not 100%. And that's something that we have to look at fairly and squarely, and sort out remedies and perhaps compensation too. But all in all, it shouldn't in any real world kind of assessment of the situation come as any surprise that there are going to be some drawbacks to something that was hailed as a miracle, quite deservedly, at the time when it was produced. Although the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has always been slightly out of the immediate and first mainstream of Pfizer's and Moderna's. They operate in a different way and other variable forms of success have been consequent on that. It's regrettable, but I think it's almost inevitable.
And one final comment on Ukraine. Of course, Russia is coming up on a big anniversary day, celebrating their defeat of the Germans and the Ukrainians. Once again, their army is doing an incredible job in holding the line now in the east of Ukraine. What's your view of that? Yeah, I am sitting here thinking that when Russia has their big celebration, with what's been going on inside Russia with these chemical plants and these munitions plants being blown up, you know that Vladimir Putin really has to be worried that the Ukrainians don't do something to affect the big celebration that's going to go on in Russia.
Yes, the whole point of the May 9th recognition of the sacrifices made by citizens of the then Soviet Union in defeating Nazi Germany, it's generally speaking an opportunity to proclaim unity in Russia, and also, of course, the sort of universal sense, perhaps not shared totally 100% universally, but nonetheless there as part of Russia's sense of itself as being, you know, victorious in the fight against Nazism, against fascism. These are terms that are still used, even though the Soviet Union is no more. But Russia still sees itself, especially in the nationalistic frame of mind encouraged by Putin himself, as heroes. And sacrificing heroes at that. I mean, the sheer volume of loss suffered by the Russian population and the Soviet Union population as a whole, too, of course. The other countries were involved. And now the Russian Federation alone, although it's a pretty sizable entity, continues that tradition every May. And it was surely, inevitably, part of Putin's thinking in launching his so-called limited military operation in Ukraine, success in that operation would be folded into the celebrations on May 9th. Well, we've got 3 days to go, and I think that's very unlikely to happen. Putin may want to declare victory in Ukraine, but the evidence on the ground simply will not allow him to do that. The Ukrainians are putting up such an extraordinary fight with, you know, help from a lot of other countries in terms of the hardware, at least, and indeed sometimes intelligence, as we just referred to. Whatever Putin was hoping would come out in time for May 9th in terms of bolstering of his role as a defeater of fascism, it's just not going to happen, is it?
You know, I just sit here and I go back to the first war, Desert Storm, where when we pushed Iraq out of a country, us and 70 other countries, people asked the general Schwarzkopf, why didn't you go and just to get rid of Saddam Hussein? And he just looked at the microphone without even blinking and said, because that was not the job we were here for. We were not here to take over a country. We were here to help expel a country from another country. Sooner or later, these big countries have got to learn it's not that easy to go into these countries and try to do regime change. It's just not. It always ends up disastrous.
Right. And remember, the other big difference between that and the current contention worldwide, it has become, is that in that case, in the case of Iraq and Kuwait, it was simply a matter of, I say simply, it was very complicated managing to produce it, but it was, all in all, remember the great phrase, the force which achieved this expulsion was a coalition force. Yes. It was called the Coalition of the Willing. And many countries joined in that effort, quite the opposite of this case, in which Russia is alone in pursuing its aggressive invasion of a neighboring country.
And the coalition that is formed is against Russia. I don't think
that's true. They've created a coalition on the opposite side very effectively, and you know, not just in terms of diplomacy and military strategy, but in terms of their own economy too. Russia's economy is being severely tested by this whole reckless enterprise.
All right. Well, it's going to be very interesting to speak to you next week to see what happens eventually in Northern Ireland and the fallout from what happens with, quote, Bojo, end quote.
Yes, all eyes on Bojo this week. I'll speak to you next week.
All right. Take care, David.
Bye.
David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David, of course, at his own website, themediabeat.us, and at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on David Tarachuk with The Media Beat.